Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. The program is Meet the Author, and my name is Denny Griffin. And for the next half hour, I will be your host, and we're going to be talking about books. And as of the moment, my scheduled guest has not called in, so hopefully he'll be on with us shortly. However, if something has happened that he is unable to make or I don't hear from him, I do have an excellent alternate guest for this evening. So my scheduled guest is Walter Crum. That's K-R-U-M-M. And he's the author of Diary of a Dead Man. And that is the story about the inner battles faced when struggling against temptation in the first page of Diary of a Dead Man. And protagonist Cameron Taylor discovers he has become involved with a very dangerous woman, a woman who earns a living blackmailing hundreds of adulterous men. In the meantime, some very serious crimes have taken place, from murder to real estate scams to money laundering. It's a race against time, and Taylor must save his family and salvage his marriage before it's too late. So that is a brief synopsis of the book. And again, if Walter is able to get to us, we will talk to him about the book. Now, in the meantime, I indicated to you that I have a very special guest to fill in for Walter until we do hear from him. And that special guest is one of my favorite authors, and his name is Denny Griffin. It happens to be myself. Only kidding about that, about being the favorite author. But it just so happens that my 10th book became available about 3 weeks ago, and I'll spend a few minutes talking about that. The name of the book is Vegas Vixen, and it's the third in my trilogy featuring the same Las Vegas homicide detectives, male and female team. The male half is Steve Garno. The female half is Teresa Terry Bolton. And the Vegas Vixen story begins with a murder that occurred on Christmas Eve of 2002. It's the murder of a 67-year-old woman in an exclusive area of Las Vegas. And Detective Garno initially catches the case. His partner is out on administrative leave. Terry shot and killed her boyfriend with her service weapon on Thanksgiving, and she's awaiting to go have the case presented to a coroner's jury at inquest. So Steve starts out working the case with a temporarily assigned senior detective who is on the verge of retirement, a not very nice individual that most people in the department really can't stand. At any rate, the scene that Garno finds when he gets to the murder location is barren of any clues. There's no the victim is fully clothed. Money and credit cards are available on a coffee table near the body. There's no evidence of forced entry, no evidence of robbery, no evidence of sexual assault. One bullet from a small caliber gun behind her left ear. As Steve gets into the investigation with his forced upon him partner, temporary partner, he learns that the victim, Christina Patterson, is retired, and her former occupation was as the madam of the best whorehouse in Sin City. And what happens is Steve is unable to come up with a modern-day motive for the killing. So he has to go back in time. He has to go back to when Christina Patterson ran her brothel and later an escort service, looking for a reason that someone would have wanted her dead, possibly a motive of revenge for some perceived wrong. Possibly she posed a threat to someone. So operating under the assumption that the reason for the killing is from the old days, Steve's supervisor tells him that although he and his temporary partner are not getting along at all, that he may very well have to work closely with this 30-plus year veteran, because when this guy started out, he was a vice cop for the old Las Vegas City Police Department. And if anybody would have had any current member of the department would have had a handle on Christina Patterson in her working days, it would be this guy. So that's the basic plot, what they have to go through in going back in time to Vegas of the 50s and 60s and how the place was run with crooked politicians, crooked cops, and the whole deal. So anyway, I believe it's an entertaining story. I know I enjoyed writing it. And I was able to create a realistic scenario of old Vegas from the research I've done for my nonfiction books, which are Vegas Mob History. My first book in that arena was actually the police history of Las Vegas, called Policing Las Vegas. And that book covered from 1905 through 2005. And at the time, Vegas and Clark County each had their own law enforcement departments. It was Las Vegas City Police and Clark County Sheriffs. In 1973, the two agencies merged to form the current Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. So that book and what I learned from researching it was a great benefit to me in writing Vegas Vixen. Also, I've written two mob books, organized crime books about Las Vegas. The first one that came out in July of 2006 is titled The Battle for Las Vegas, The Law Versus the Mob. And if any of you have ever seen the movie Casino, there was a 1995 film. Director was Martin Scorsese. Screenwriter, Nick Pileggi. And it starred Robert De Niro. And he played Ace Rothstein, the character. And that Rothstein character was actually based on the real-life Frank Lefty Rosenthal. And in fact, the Lefty Rosenthal just passed away here a couple of weeks ago at the age of 79. And it also starred Joe Pesci. Joe Pesci played a character named Nicky Santoro. And Santoro's was actually based on the real-life Chicago outfit enforcer Tony Spilotro. And Tony was sent to Vegas by the Chicago outfit bosses to give Lefty a hand, helping him run the skim operation. And basically, he's a troubleshooter should any should it develop any problems develop regarding the skim or the outfit's operations in Las Vegas. The movie also starred Sharon Stone, and Sharon played, in the movie her name was Ginger, and she played kind of a loose girl, a showgirl, turned topless dancer, turned casino hustler, and De Niro fell in love with her, and they subsequently were married, so she became Mrs. Rothstein. Her real name was Jerry McGee, a Southern California girl. And there were several other well-known actors, actresses in the movie. And I also wrote a book, my second book about the Las Vegas mob was a biography I co-authored. And the name of the book is Collotta, C-U-L-L-O-T-T-A, The Life of a Chicago Criminal, Las Vegas Mobster, and Government Witness. And it's the biography of Frank Collotta, who was a boyhood friend in Chicago of Tony Spilotro's, a career criminal. And after being released from prison in the 70s, a state prison in Illinois. He joined Tony, who had already been assigned to Las Vegas. And Frank ran a crew of burglars, arsonists, and killers known as the Hole in the Wall Gang. And they got their name because at the time, most places didn't have motion alarms. They alarmed the doors and windows, but if you could bypass those alarms, there was a good chance you weren't going to be detected in the house or in the business, and you could go about your work. So what they did, and because the construction here in Las Vegas in the warmer weather is a little less than it would be, less sturdy than it might be in some of the colder climates, what they would do is they'd use sledgehammers to weaken a wall, then go through it, thereby bypassing alarmed doors and windows. So the Hole in the Wall Gang. And they also used similar methods on occasion to go through roofs. For example, if they were burglarizing a business and wanted to land right on top of the safe, then there'd be too much chance of being exposed in a business area of trying to go through a sidewall. What they would do is they would go through the roof and well-planned capers where they would land right on top of the vault. So Frank and Tony were kind of the kings of the Vegas underworld at that point and their gang. They provided muscle. They would, in addition to stealing anything they could virtually get their hands on, one former police officer told me that these guys could be sitting in a restaurant with 10 grand in their pocket. They would walk across to a convenience store and steal a pack of gum just because they had to steal. It was kleptos. And they were quite a crew. Some of the guys weren't into violence real heavy. They were primarily burglars, thieves, and then you had other members who would do it all. They would rob, burglarize, and kill or rough people up, as the case may be, when the situation was warranted. And they used to make a lot of their money from robbing drug dealers. They would know who the drug dealers were. They would know where they lived. They would rob them, take their cash and their drugs, and then they would resell the drugs on the street. And they had perfect victims because they weren't in a position to complain to the police. It would be rather awkward to call the police up and say, hey, we had a whole bunch of illegal drugs here and illegal money we obtained from selling the illegal drugs and somebody stole it from us. So that was a fairly safe class of victim. They also did a lot of illegal bookie intimidation and robbery. And the bookies who were operating here, this was before every casino had a real class sports book and so forth. There used to be illegal bookmaking operations. And these illegal operations, the Chicago outfit, if they were going to operate, they wanted them to pay a street tax, a so-called street tax, where they would kick some of their profits back to the Chicago outfit. And one of Tony Spilotro's jobs and his employees was to make sure these illegal bookies either paid up or were put out of business. So between the drug dealers and the illegal bookmakers, these guys had plenty of business, plus, of course, they robbed legitimate businesses and homeowners. And speaking of the homeowners, they screened their victims very carefully, because they didn't want to waste time or possible arrest, possible jail time, breaking into the house or robbing from someone who didn't have any money or assets. That would be foolhardy. So they used tipsters. They had tipsters all over the hotels, casinos, valet parkers, what have you, maids, desk clerks. And they would get information about the potential victim's assets or their appearance, if it appeared they were wearing fancy clothes, perhaps furs, jewelry, and so forth. And they'd also get information about their activities. For example, if they went to the bellhop and wanted to know what the best show in town was, and could they get tickets, or where they might be qualified to be comped to a show or something. If they looked like lucrative targets, whoever was making the arrangements for the victim's entertainment for the evening would place a call to Frank Collada or Tony Spilotro. And while the victim is going to be out of their room for the evening, a burglar would come in, usually obtain a pass key from the maid, and so on and so forth, and go in and clean out if the room had a safe, or if money was just stashed, or jewelry was stashed in a drawer or a closet. And then, of course, the tipsters got usually 10% of the take. So it worked out well for everybody. And they also used valet parkers. The valet parkers would screen their clients. They would take a look at what type of car they were driving. Of course, they could tell if it was a rental car or something indicating a tourist or somebody picked it up at the airport. And they would also be able to tell from the plates if it was a local Las Vegas registered car. And if it looked like the occupants had money, again, the dress, the jewelry, that type of thing, they do a little, what indicated was just casual conversation, but it was information gathering about how long are you in town, Mr. Smith, blah, blah, blah. And are you going to be here long or short term? Well, no, I'm a guest at the hotel, so the car will be here a while. Or no, I'm a local, I'm just meeting some friends here, we're going to do dinner and a show, what have you. So they would get an idea of how the victim usually felt that they were being asked these questions to determine whether they were going to be parked, their car would be parked in a long-term or short-term area. Well, if it was a local, generally the registration would be in the glove box with a home address and the whole thing. If it was a guest who was staying at the hotel, of course, then the people at the desk, reservation desk, would have the information as to what room they were in. A call would be made to Frank or his people, and they would come over and get, in the case of a local, they would actually get in the victim's car, drive it to the victim's residence, use the garage door opener or house key and the key ring, go in the house, clean out what they wanted, and they weren't really into lugging big like televisions and that type of stuff. They were looking for cash and jewelry primarily. And what they would do is they'd take that, and they were making so much money and taking in so much stuff that Tony Spilotro had actually opened a jewelry store called the Gold Rush. And they would drop the stuff off at the Gold Rush, the hot items. Then they would return the car to the valet area. And the victim would come out later and take his car, usually give the valet attendant a pretty good tip, and drive home and not even realize he'd been burglarized until they went to get their jewelry or what have you. And these guys knew where people tended to hide money, where they would tend to have maybe secret, something in the floor that was covered with a carpeting, some kind of a hidden compartment. I was told by Frank that people loved to hide money behind light switches. So they would take the plate off of the light switch and a lot of times find cash in that area, stuff taped to the bottoms of dresser drawers and so on. And, if it was jewelry or money that they were just stashing, they might not look for it for weeks or months. And, of course, the burglars were long clear and they wouldn't even associate it with the valet. And because I asked Frank when we were writing his book, I said, do you ever feel guilty? Does it ever bother you that you stole from all these people? I mean, maybe your business is one thing, but were stealing from the citizens who lived here. And he said, no, he said, and his reasoning was most of them and most of the victims ended up better off after Frank or his people paid them a visit. And he explained that one of their chief sources, besides valet or people being at the hotel, chief sources for information for targets were insurance agents. So if I want to, if I buy my wife an expensive piece of jewelry and I want that covered under my homeowners in case something happens, I go down and I tell my insurance agent, and sometimes you have to have an appraisal or whatever as to the value of the merchandise you want insured. And the insurance agents, once they find this out, and of course you have to tell them your security arrangements, where the stuff is going to be stashed in your house. Do you have dogs? Do you have alarms? All that stuff. So these people, these insurance agents, would then call Frank or his boys and tell them what they found, you know, through the application for the extra insurance or a rider, and exactly where the stuff would be located, security precautions and all that, and they would go and make their score. But these same insurance agents, also that office received the claim forms. After a burglary was discovered, these people would file on their homeowner's insurance. And according to Frank, he and his boys weren't the only crooks in town. That most of these people were making claims for a lot of stuff that the burglars never got. So Frank's contention was that the victims generally ended up better off after he and his people visited them than they did before. So he had no feelings of remorse or guilt whatsoever. And the other thing they did was from arson for hire. People were maybe had a business that wasn't making any money, wasn't paying off the way they had hoped, and they would take a real bath if they just closed up. So what they would want to do was have the place burned down. And Frank and some of his other people were experts at arson. Frank had the ability to make almost anything look like an accident. And for the right price, they would go and torch a building. And then the owner of the building would pay them a hefty fee, and then he would collect on his insurance. And then the business could go belly up without suffering any financial loss or maybe making a profit on the deal. And, of course, if people had to be, if people weren't paying their debts to markers, to mob-operated casinos and so forth, Franklin's boys would also rough them up. He had one individual working for him by the name of Larry Newman. He was called Lurch because of his physical appearance. And Frank said he was so mean and nasty that he would scare a hungry dog off the back of a garbage truck. So he was one of their main. All he had to do was approach somebody, he'd virtually scare them into submission just by his looks. And he killed at least six people that we're aware of. And he was nobody muck, and he had money. This was not the case of a poor person, you know, broken, come from a broken family and have to struggle to make ends meet. This guy had money, and he stole and killed because he liked it, not out of necessity. So anyway, this crew, and it was quite an operation. So that book, Colada, and the funny thing, over the summer, I received an email from the publisher's publicity person, and a reader had tried to get a hold of me, didn't know how to, so he sent an email to the publicity department of Huntington Press. And when a friend of his, an acquaintance of his, a lady named Holly, when she had been reading Colada over the summer, on page 130 she found a double homicide that had taken place in 1981 in McHenry County, Illinois. And it didn't, it was discussed there, and starting on the page 130, it didn't give the names of the victims. It was a bar owner and his barmaid had been shot to death. But it gave the name of the killer, Larry Newman. And it turned out that this girl, Holly, who had read the book, she used to babysit for the victim's son. And although the names weren't there, everything else matched. So eventually the son, the victim's son, was informed. He bought the book and read it. And the first time in 27 years that he found out the identity of the person who killed his father. And there's an effort underway right now to get the officials in McHenry County to close that case out. As it's currently still is a cold case because homicides are never closed. So there was, I was very pleased that after all this time, this family might have some closure, at least to know who killed their dad and or his dad and the two children of the barmaid who had been murdered also. So that was a good feeling. And I did find out that the McHenry County authorities are in fact reopened or reactivated, I should say, their investigation, and might even make some arrests in the case. So that's very good. At any rate, all this background helped me with Vixen to come up with how things were done back in the 60s and 70s, the environment of Las Vegas at the time, and the police departments, the two different departments in the earlier years prior to the consolidation and forming Metro. So it really worked out very well for me. So in addition to the fun it was for me doing the research for my police history and my mob history books, it also made it fun to write Vegas Vixen because I took that knowledge and could create my own little world of for Christina Patterson and what happened when she came to Vegas and how she ended up being murdered. So it was a lot of fun. And like I say, that book has just been released about 3 weeks ago. It's now available on Amazon and through the publisher. And I have links from my website, DennisNGriffin.com, to the book. And I also recently have my first two books in that trilogy, Killer in Paradise and One-Armed Bandit, are out now in audiobook. And I've listened to both of those, and the reader did a very good job. I also have Collada and The Battle for Las Vegas in audiobook. And these are all through Books in Motion. And they're available through Amazon, too. It can be ordered through Amazon or from the Books in Motion website. And Vegas Vixen is at Books in Motion as we speak. And I don't know just where it is in the Quay, but that's going to be an audio book also, hopefully within the next couple of months. Well, we're getting close to the end of the program, and Walter never did call in, so I don't have any idea what happened, but I had been thinking about doing a little session on my new book and some of my older books at any time, so I just actually worked out well for me in Walter's absence. Now, I'm going to be doing another show on the 25th, and it's going to be very entertaining, I believe. My guest is going to be Tony Napoli. And Tony is a real-life mobster, I should say former mobster. Worked for the Genovese crime family out of New York City. Their godfather, one of the more recent ones, was Tony the Chin Gigante. And we're going to be talking about Tony's new book. The title is My Father, My Don. And it's going to be, his father was a capo in the group before Tony, when Tony was a kid. And I've read the book, and it's very interesting. If you're into organized crime, or specifically if you're into the New York crime families, I think you'll enjoy it. So that will be on the 25th, 8 p.m. Eastern. And thanks for listening, and hope to catch you then. Have a good night.